little boy about 5 years old announced that when he grew up, he was going to be a preacher. When asked why, he said, well, if you got to go, you might as well be the one talking and getting paid for it. Don't feel that way at all this morning, but I do welcome you to our service and hope that something that's said here, I take very seriously the time that all of us spend together. Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz says there's no place like home. And that immediately brings the question, well, where's home? How do you define home? Well, one of the definitions that I like so much is Robert Frost's definition in The Hired Man that we'll refer to a little bit later on. Home is the place where, when you have to go there, they have to take you in. Now, keep that at the back of your mind, especially as we go through this session this morning. I think of three places. First of all, there's your church home, your church family. Secondly, there's your family of origin, your biological family. And then thirdly, there's your heavenly home. And in many ways, those three overlap. And over the next 3 weeks, we're going to look at all three of those. This morning, focusing on church home. I really at times say I would love to have a discussion period where we can all talk about our experiences or our points of view. And at this moment, I'm thinking about churches in the past, your personal experience at church, maybe your experience as a child or at other critical moments in your life. I think it would be really interesting to share those experiences. My personal ones center primarily around my grandparents. My grandparents were very serious about church, and as I've told you a number of times before, we as children, we spent our summers with grandparents in little bitty church in Tribby, Oklahoma. About 30, 35 people would show up on a weekly basis. Right now, if you were at that little church, somebody would have just gotten up and gone outside to take a water hose and spray it on the water coolers so that it would be just a little bit cooler in there for the last of that service. When we lived in Alamogordo, when my dad was at Holloman, he preached periodically at a little place called Weed that was up in the mountains. I understand it's a much bigger place than what it used to be, but the people there would bring food for lunch. And there was no kitchen or anything like that. There was just a wood stove in the middle of the church. And they would sit the food on that stove. It would smell so good during the service. You couldn't wait for church to be over and have an opportunity to participate in the fellowship because it smelled awfully good. Those memories kind of run counter to what people practice, though. Because the reality is, no matter how we look back on our past or our memories, church attendance is declining. It's rapidly declining in our world. All we have to do is look to the empty churches of Europe, and we see exactly the same pattern beginning in our own culture and in our own society. And we can look pretty easily into a future that is not very positive. Some years, a decline of 17% is the largest one in the last decade. And do the math just a minute. You don't have to figure that very long before you see how you get to the bottom very, very quickly. Why are people going to church? Well, some people don't believe in it. They don't believe in God anymore. They don't believe in prayer anymore. Some people are frustrated with the folks they meet at church. But by and large, the single greatest issue about church attendance is time. Just don't have time to go. Or it's not at a good time. And you probably can certainly remember the fact that we've switched our Saturdays to Sundays now. I remember as I was growing up, Saturday was the day that you slept late and caught up on errands and that sort of thing. And now in our world, that's changed and it's become Sunday. This morning, as I was putting stuff in the car, my neighbors were busy all around me doing the Saturday things that used to be on that day. And so there are a lot of people who like the idea of church. There are a lot of people who find benefit in church attendance, but they just find it being squeezed out of their lives by the way time works in our world. This morning, I'd like to quickly remind you of just a handful of things that church attendance can do for us and really make a significant difference in our lives practically and certainly spiritually as well. The first thing that's so important to me is a spiritual network. I don't care what your family of origin was like, you need an additional spiritual family. You may have had this wonderful wonderful biological family, but for many of us, those people aren't here, or at least a number of them aren't here. Maybe they don't live nearby. When we lived in Houston, we went to a large congregation out on the northern side of town. There was a kind of a saying back then that nobody was from Houston, and in that congregation, there were no families. There were no extended families at all. Everybody was pretty much a newcomer to this area. And so there were people who played grandchildren for other people's children. People did that for our children. You built connections in this spiritual context. And those connections were so, so critical. You may have come from a biological family that was not spiritual at all. You may have come from a biological family that held values that were inconsistent with Christian beliefs, or maybe you came from a family that pretended to have Christian values and really didn't. And all of those things complicate the picture. And then there are people who come along and say, I've got it all figured out. I don't need to go to church. And my response to them always is, well, come because you have something to offer the rest of us. You can encourage us. You can help us. You can help us to get to where you are. Those spiritual connections, that network, is just so critical. In 2 Corinthians chapter 8, verse 14, a passage we typically use in the context of money, and that's what Paul is talking about here. At the present time, your plenty will supply what they need, so that in turn, their plenty will supply what you need. The goal is equality. And that applies emotionally and spiritually as well. There are times when you're stronger. There are times when you have resources that maybe you don't have at another point in time, and you're able to utilize those resources to help other people. That leads easily to the second one. That's encouragement. A passage was read earlier from Hebrews chapter 10, verses 24 and 25. Not giving up meeting together as some are in the habit of doing, but encouraging one another, and all the more as you see the day approaching. Part of what we do here today is encourage each other. Doesn't take a long time. It isn't difficult. Sometimes just seeing somebody else at church is an encouragement. But it goes beyond that. Research shows that for every criticism you receive, you need 8 compliments. Now, is there anybody who lives in a world where that's a truth in your life? Where you get 8 times as many compliments as you get criticisms? There are probably some of you sitting there thinking, well, if you switch that, you get closer to the reality of my life. And that really can be the way life is lived. We're constantly getting negatives from other people. We need to have exposure to people who love us and care about us, so much so that they'll say that. And in an even more serious context, the 23rd Psalm mentions the valley of the shadow of death. Doesn't mean necessarily death, just the threat. Those times when we can't do anything about what we're experiencing. I don't have it within me. I can't deal with a major health issue. I can't deal with a major financial issue. I can't deal with the loss of life. I can't deal with the breakup of the relationship. And on it goes. We don't have within us the resources to do that. And so if we just sit out there and hurt, we easily become vulnerable to Satan's complete and total takeover. But when we rise to help each other, it can be so beneficial, even at the darkest moment. I can remember moments of crisis, people in hospitals and cemeteries and rehab and various other kinds of situations where connections were made and bonds were forged that took the highest degree of intense heat. But those bonds last for a very long time. The third thing I would mention is confirmation. Recently, Terry reconnected with one of the kids who was in our youth group back in Houston, a guy in his 50s now. Seems impossible to believe. I still see him as a 17-year-old. But they talked back and forth on the internet, and then he sent us a personal letter. And it was really special, and I won't share with you, obviously, the whole thing. But one of the things that he said in there was, "You were the first people to confirm what my parents had taught me." And the reality of that really kind of becomes fairly clear. Where do kids find out that other people hold the values that they've been taught at home? Well, they find that here. They find that in their church relationships. They find others who hold those same points of view. And they find in that confirmation something that really is powerful and really is useful. Philippians chapter 1, verse 7. "Is it right for me to feel this way about all of you? In my heart, and whether I'm in chains or defending and confirming the gospel, all of you share in God's grace with me." They're the confirmation of what Paul's life is all about. Literally, the reason he's in prison. And last but not least, we just need reminders. Probably you come to church and say, "I didn't hear anything new today." Well, it's not about new. It's about God's word. There are times when maybe you hear something that you hadn't heard before, and it speaks to you in a different way. And we're reminded. And constantly people say, "Well, I can worship out here. I can worship watching TV, or I can worship doing this and that." And you can. But we miss some of those important reminders that we get when we gather together. 2 Peter chapter 1. Yeah, 2 Peter 1:12. "So I will always remind you of these things, even though you know them and are firmly established in the truth you now have." Peter says, "I'm going to keep telling you about this. You already know this stuff, but I'm going to continue to remind you." I want to say this out loud. The folks at church aren't perfect. You could probably say fairly that the folks at church are a mess. Because we are. We've managed to complicate our lives. We're imperfect people. We may be trying very hard to change from our carnal selves to our spiritual selves. We may be really putting effort into making that transition, and hopefully that's a truth and a reality. But the people at church aren't perfect. I've shared with you before, back when Jonathan was in junior high, I had a guy at church. One of the deacons came to me and he said, "You know, I've watched Jonathan play tennis. I've watched you play soccer. I think he would be a really good golfer. And I'm teaching my son to play golf, and I would like to take him out once a week and teach him how to play golf." And so I said, "Sure, they can do that." They went out to Cedar Valley the first time, and Jonathan had a blast, really enjoyed it. We sat at the supper table that night or later, I don't remember exactly, and I said, "Jonathan, tell me what you learned on your golf lesson." He said, "Well, I learned how to jimmy the practice ball basket so you could get practice balls free and you didn't have to pay for them." And I thought, boy, that was what I was hoping you'd learn. Yeah. This deacon had shown him how to cheat the machine. If you left it there, you could think, well, this is not much of a leader. But you don't get to leave it there. This is a guy who's been part of our lives for 35 years. This is a guy who showed up one night when my dad was just about to die and said, "I want to take you to dinner." This is a guy who's shown up the first day we moved into our house and said, "I want to help you move in." This is a guy who over and over and over again has reached out as a brother and as a friend. And if he were here today, he would say, "I'm not perfect. I'm just trying." And probably he would say, "I wish I hadn't taught Jonathan how to do that. That would be something I wish hadn't even occurred in my life." We look around at churches sometimes and we say, "Boy, I'd like to go to a perfect, wonderful, good church." Go with me to Acts chapter 2, the church we find in the follow-up to the mass baptism that took place at Pentecost. So they devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching and to fellowship, to the breaking of bread and to prayer. Everyone was filled with awe at the many wonders and signs performed by the apostles. All the believers were together and had everything in common. They sold property and possessions to give to anyone who had need. Every day they continued to meet together in the temple courts. They broke bread in their homes and ate together with glad and sincere hearts, praising God and enjoying the favor of all the people. And the Lord added to their number daily those who were being saved. You read that description of that church, that first church in Jerusalem, and you go, now that's the church I'd like to go to. That's the church where I would be glad to be a member. That's the kind of church that would meet my needs. And yet when you look carefully at that church, that's just one frozen moment in time. They're doing a wonderful thing, no doubt about it, but it's not going to last. Quickly, death and division, diversion, all kinds of things are going to come into this. And this church isn't going to be at this mountaintop much longer. We have mountaintop experiences in our church fellowships, and that's great. It's encouraging. They don't last. They don't hold because we're imperfect people, and soon Satan's able to get his way. From Psalms chapter 55, and I'm not going to take time to read this, David talks about how he wished he had the wings of a dove that he could fly away and be at rest. And if you read later into that chapter, he talks about the fact that he goes to worship with somebody who he thought was his friend. But it turns out that this enemy, this one who's giving him so much trouble, is this person that he used to care about so much. And a lot of times when people read that 53rd Psalm, they say, I understand, David. I've been to church with people who let me down. I've been to church with people who weren't there when I needed them. I've been there. I understand that. There's an old story called Cold Nights and Porcupines. I've never been able to confirm whether this is true or not. If you know, let me know. The story is based on the fact that it's a real cold night, and the porcupines come together to share a little bit of heat, but as soon as they do, they start needling each other. And so they have to move back away, and they get cold, and they come back together and start needling each other. And this process takes place, and you can see the parallel. Now, whether that's true or not, I don't know. But I do know that the sociological tenet of distance, closeness, and some people refer to it as a dance, is true. We pull together, and then for reasons that we don't fully understand, we back away. And we do this distance, closeness dance. And if you find somebody who's at the farthest edge of the distance, then maybe they don't feel very good about the core at all. And at other times when you're at the center, the core is just so good and so wonderful and so right. And unfortunately, because of our imperfections, we're going to push and we're going to pull. And it's not always going to be as good as we'd like for it to be. And it's rarely going to be as bad as we're afraid that it might be. I started this morning by using Robert Frost's Death of a Hired Man. I'd like to share with you one section of that. You may know that Mary, the wife, is explaining to Warren, her husband, that Silas, their hired man, has come back. And Warren is determined that Silas is not going to stay. Silas is not responsible. Silas will find a better job. Silas will find somebody who cares more. Silas will leave at a moment when you need him and you have to go find somebody else. And he's arguing very much that there's not a chance, he's going to say. Mary's so concerned about Silas that she says, Warren, he's come home to die. You needn't be afraid he'll leave you this time. Home, he mocked. Yes, what else but home? It all depends on what you mean by home. Of course he's nothing to us any more than was the hound that came a stranger to us out of the woods, worn out by the trail. And then Mary says, home is the place where when you have to go there, they have to take you in. And then she explains some more by saying, I should have called it something you somehow haven't to deserve. God looks at us and he says, come home. And we say, I don't deserve to be home. And God reaches back and says, I didn't ask you if you deserve to be here. I'm inviting you to come home. And in the whole theology, we understand that God let his son die on a cross so that we can deserve to be here. It's such an incredible thing to believe, and yet the reality is simply so clear. God put us in these homes. He put us in biological homes, but he also put us in spiritual homes because he knew we would need that experience. And this morning, if that's not part of your life, please make it part of your life. Find those resources and find those opportunities and build those connections and allow other people to build those kind of connections with you. You can lean on in those moments that are so heavy and so hard. If there's something we can do to help you spiritually, we'd be glad to do that. If you'd make that clear while we sing this song together.